wanted to share today some of the activities that the Lead Poisoning Prevention and Healthy Housing Branch at CDC has been engaged in over the last several years. We've been conducting blood lead prevalence surveys with our partners, most notably in of recent dates, Philadelphia, Puerto Rico, Los Angeles, and then internationally, Nigeria and Jakarta, Indonesia. So the challenges today with lead poisoning, as most of you are probably aware, are deteriorated lead paint, consumer products to a lesser extent, traditional medicines to a lesser extent, and point sources. The take home here is 1.1 million homes have significant lead-based paint hazards where children live. Generally, these are low-income housing. The focus of CDC and the partners, the state and local partners, has been primary prevention, trying to address the problems before they happen. Notable here on this slide are this is the NHANES slide that shows the blood levels significantly decreasing to less than 1% blood levels greater or equal to 10 today. And these are the lead control measures that the U.S. government implemented, and phasing out lead and gasoline, banning lead paint, reducing, eliminating lead and solder. Those are some of the major milestones that happened. So why have we been conducting these? Well, we've been looking at areas that may not have strong surveillance data, may not know the lead sources that are exposing the populations, trying to get a baseline for how we can move forward in different areas, looking at point sources, those kind of issues. Let's see if I'm forgetting anything. Okay. The value of conducting these is we're targeting communities with inequitable exposures, oftentimes developing a capacity to respond to cases that weren't previously identified, and basically supplying data when there is none. And I'm just going to talk about the methods, but there's obviously a lot more that go into these studies. Human subject review, identifying funding, identifying partners, training field staff, those kind of things. These are some examples of study objectives that we've assessed, and basically the nice part of it is that we usually get an unbiased prevalence estimate. We can get a weighted geometric mean, which allows us to compare to NHANES, a weighted prevalence estimate. We just weight up to using the census data, looking at blood levels 5 or higher or 10 or higher, identifying risk factors or protective factors for sources of exposure to lead, looking at point source and distance to point sources, interpreting lead levels in the environment, so soil, dust wipes, indoor water, especially around where children play, and then using some of the data to estimate prevalence ratios. Generally, the study design is a representative population-based cross-sectional study. Sometimes random sampling surveys available, but most of the time we do the cluster stage survey, which is done in disaster response, immunization assessments, refugee health, or other areas that use these two-stage cluster surveys. Important things to consider are the response rate. Are we getting people participating that are representative? Is the power strong enough? Is the sample size large enough? Collecting information about non-responders so we can be sure we're getting correct information. Conducting field work in a scientifically rigorous way. Are we collecting venous samples versus capillary samples? Who are our partners? Usually they give a wide range of partners, NGOs, students, obviously local and state health departments. And then what are the resources? What can we do when we do identify? Because we always identify something in these populations that merit response. So how well equipped are we to respond afterwards? The study area is where we conduct the study and we recruit and sample. When we look at point sources, literature shows about a 2.7 kilometer distance is considered proximate to a point source, so that sometimes is our border. Again, when the territory, our study area is large, we're going to get away from a simple random sample and use the cluster survey design, and then the household is our primary sampling unit. For the study population, we consider age of the child, length of time at the residence, the age of housing, sometimes proximity to a point source, a parental hobby or occupation, use of lead-containing products like traditional medicines, foods, those kind of things. When we do employ the sampling methodology, the cluster survey design, we in stage one, we randomly select the clusters, usually 30 to 40, and then in stage two, we randomly select the households within those clusters, usually 7 to 10, using, and again, we will calculate a sample size and a power calculation. Things to consider in data collection and entry are we going to go out in the field with electronic devices? Are we going to use paper? What's our visitation protocol? Making sure we revisit the houses, that we don't leave any stones unturned. Use of geographic information. Generally, enter the data into EpiInfo or Access. EpiInfo, of course, is available for free. Always consider whether we're going to do capillary or venous sampling. Sometimes the contamination issue comes up with capillary sampling. We can use the LeadCare 2 devices in the field. They also have the ability to take off the regulator, so we can actually get a result, not a less than or a greater than, but we can actually get a result. Quality control is important. We usually, if we do capillary in the field, we're going to get about a 10% venous sample for on the same kits. And generally, we'll use the LeadCare 2 in the field, and then the whatever lab we're working with, we'll use the graphite furnace or the ICPM PMS to analyze the venous samples. The environmental data is important as well. Sometimes we will collect it all for the sample, or sometimes just a random selection. Interior dust, usually where the child plays, the front door, those kind of places. Exterior soil where the child plays, usually a composite sample. We'll do water sampling, and if we're lucky enough, sometimes we'll go. We'll have some XRF machines so we can measure the lead content in paint or anything else that the resident might want us to measure. And reporting results is very important to parents and the guardians, involving the healthcare provider, understanding what we're doing in the area, and obviously confidentiality is important. These are some examples of the cluster survey design that we did. The Nigerian lead epidemic that happened in 2010 surveyed 119 families that were using gold ore processing machinery in their compounds, and this was just tragic, where 26% of children when we arrived had already died in the previous 12 months due to elevated lead. 82% of those deaths involved convulsions, and 97% of the children living less than 5 years had blood levels 45 or higher. So our response involved was a real wide response that went beyond our normal activities. In Puerto Rico, in contrast, this was a finding where we didn't find a lot of elevated lead levels. This study was conducted because we were seeing in the regular routine surveillance data in New York and other states that children from Puerto Rico were having elevated blood lead levels, but we didn't find a lot of elevated cases there. In fact, it mirrored NHANES, and these were our sampling locations. And in Philadelphia, this was a point source investigation that we had done last summer, and we found similar to the Philadelphia surveillance data, but we're still assessing the point source. And we also found that the more elevated lead they had in their environment, the greater the odds ratios were for elevated blood lead levels. So these are something we've been doing for a while, are going to continue to do. They really do provide a lot of good information, carried out in a scientifically rigorous manner, and are useful for prevention and other public health activities. And I just wanted to acknowledge Mary Jean Brown and Curtis Blanton, the statistician, who's been involved in a lot of these studies. Okay, thanks.
Thank you.